Deadwood Soundweb.
You have found Dirt Maps, a tributary to The Real War Project, a podcast about the narrative, affective, and production politics of war cinema. In today's episode of Dirt Maps, we interview Dr. Amanda Taylor about her upcoming books on the rhetorical construction of the martial body, domestication, and war, and the tropes of militarism in Star Trek. If you enjoy this episode, you can find more Dirt Maps via The Real War Project. That's R-E-E-L, War Project, wherever you find your podcasts. Enjoy the show. Joining me now is Dr. Amanda Taylor. Amanda earned her PhD in 2017 from the University of Minnesota. Go Gophers! Her research focuses on late medieval and early modern English and Italian epic romances, arms and armor, and medical texts focusing on anatomy and treatment of battlefield wounds. She has published in numerous journals, including the Journal of Medieval and Early Modern Studies, Arthuriana, and the George Herbert Journal, and she's currently working on a book manuscript that builds from her dissertation entitled Fabricating the Martial Body, Anatomy, Affect, and Armor in Early Modern England and Italy, as well as a new project with co-author Dr. Emily Beck on domesticating war. She is also a program development manager for Medtronic supporting the cardiac diagnostics business, a one-time exceptional speech and debate coach, a former Carroll College debater, and a teammate of mine. Dr. Taylor, welcome to Dirt Maps, and thanks for coming back to The Real War Project.
Thanks so much for having me. That's quite the intro.
It is. And I just want to reiterate, this is your first time on the show, but you're coming back because this is the second time we've had to try to record this. Thank you for your patience and understanding. I hope it works this time. We're going to figure it out.
No problem.
It's great talking to you again. We spoke in episode 8 of my podcast, That's Debatable, about Star Wars versus Star Trek, which I think is kind of a fun way to contextualize the conversation we're going to have today about militarism in Star Trek. But before we get to any of that, I just love to ask you what we ask all of our guests when they come on, if you'd like to introduce yourself and your relationship to your research to our audience.
My relationship to my research is really driven by what I, as a 10/11-year-old little girl, like to read. Mm-hmm. And still like reading as a now nearly 40-year-old, mm-hmm. not so little girl anymore. But I read a series called The Song of the Linus Quartet by Tamara Pierce. And it's a series that's set in like, you know, fantasy version of kind of medieval England, but with like magic, of course. And there's a pair of twins, a girl and a boy, who basically look the same. And the girls from royal families would go to the City of the Gods to become well-trained in, you know, sewing and household management and go to court eventually to get a good husband. And older boys would go to the palace to train to become a knight. And younger boys would also go to the City of the Gods to train to be sorcerers or, you know, something. So they're like, well, we'll just switch places. Our dad doesn't care about anything anyway. He just reads books and nobody talks to him. So they cut their hair, or she cuts her hair. They switch places. This works out for them somehow. And
it's like a fantasy parent trap kind of thing going on here.
It sounds
like.
Exactly. Yeah, awesome. Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absent parenthood is key to the success of the strategy.
Too many fictional stories, it would seem, but go
right,
on.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. But she does, jewels it off, and the first couple books are about her being a page and then a squire and then becoming a knight and revealing her gender to everyone. And then, you know, it's all about her being a kick-ass lady knight. And so that became my dissertation project, essentially, in a nutshell. But I focus on Italian and English epic romances, which are these super long poems, basically, and have lords and ladies, knights and dragons, all this stuff. But particularly The Faerie Queen by Edmund Spenser is the main English text that I work with. And this, he wrote this to Queen Elizabeth. And it, each book is essentially about a virtue, and the virtue has kind of an avatar. And the avatar of the third book is a lady knight, Britomart. And so that was really what drew me into it. And then I, of course, you know, complicated it as one does when they write dissertations and get wrapped up in theory, and really kind of linked it to the Italian predecessors that he was pulling from, plagiarizing, some might say, and then the material culture because of, you know, like she's running around in armor. That's pretty cool. Then I need to know stuff about armor. Mm-hmm. So that's really where it came from. It's been such a love-hate relationship at times, like getting through research, as anybody knows, getting through writing can be a slog. But overall, especially considering that I've gone a non-academic track after finishing my PhD, my relationship with my research, I would say, is better. I like get to do it on my own terms and not really forced to publish or write about things that I don't want to. And so that really has improved our relationship, I would say.
Sounds glorious. yeah, amazing. You traveled a lot for your dissertation research, if I'm not mistaken, correct? You want to just touch on that real quick?
Yeah, I didn't speak Italian when I started my PhD. And my advisor, Dr. John Watkins, who is an expert on all kinds of things, but especially, you know, the reason why I wanted to work with him is he's an expert on Elizabethan politics and court and, you know, literature that was written to and about and for her. And he wrote his first part of his dissertation is on the Fairy Queen as well. So, but when I came, he was like, you can't possibly say anything interesting without knowing the Italian context. So go learn Italian. And I was like, okie dokie.
Welcome to graduate school.
Yeah. So I spent two summers with the Foreign Language Area Studies Fellowship from the Department of Education that helps support the study of lesser taught languages. And fortunately for me, Italian qualified as that. So I spent like good chunks of two summers after my second, my third years doing intensive Italian language acquisition. I've never had like a college class or anything in Italian. It's like through those programs or just like local cultural center that learned Italian. And then I was an alternate 2 years in a row for a research Fulbright to Italy. And the first time the process is so long that my husband, whom you know, and I had already like, we were like, okay, well, we're prepared to move to Italy for a year. And then when I became an alternate, it was like, okay, well, I guess we'll just keep waiting. But then we're like, we're still prepared to move to Italy. And I got a different fellowship through the university. So we just moved to Bologna for a semester. And he did Italian language studies too. And so did I. And so that was a really great experience to, you know, learn Italian. But then also I've done quite a few, you know, research trips in Italy and England and to Vienna and different parts in the United States. So that's been a super fun part of making my relationship with my research better, getting to go to fun places.
That adds a lot
cool
to
things.
It. Yeah. I think you would agree that part of speech and debate too was that getting to travel and just see different universities all over the place.
Yeah.
Sometimes it was a dumpy little town, but other times it was pretty cool. So.
Right. Well, the first time I saw the ocean as a kid from Montana was for speech and debate nationals.
Yep.
That's like, exciting. Wow, I'm 18 and this is the ocean. Cool.
This is what it's like in Montana. There are many great things in Montana. There is no ocean. They just don't.
No
they,
ocean.
You can't play that game. No. Your read-in says you're working on two projects which both sound very, very cool. Could we start with the book that's based on your dissertation? It's called Fabricating the Martial Body, Anatomy, Affect, and Armor in Early Modern England and Italy. Just like in a nutshell, how would you describe this project?
So I've got to find a new name for it, of course, because that was the dissertation name. Mm-hmm. But I haven't come to the clever title has not struck me yet. But really what it does is it takes this idea of the martial body, which is a rhetorical trope, certainly. And by the martial body, I mean, you know, the representation of like really patriarchal, you know, heteronormative masculinity in early modern England. And so, of course, if you're thinking late medieval, it's that manifestation of the knight. And so the knight in shining armor who is, you know, from a royal household and that lineage has a really long connection, obviously, to kings and, you know, anybody is better if they're a knight. So I think about this, okay, with this martial body, how's it made? What do you do with it? And how is it as a form deployable by some women and lower status men in ways that help them to sort of transgress the boundaries that are expected because of the social context that they live within, that they can use that as a way to sort of authorize transgressive behavior. So what I start with then is like, okay, what is it made of? And I'm really invested a lot in the medical theory and understanding of the time. So the first chapter takes the allegory of the body, which is figured as a castle, with the soul, which is female, in book two of the Fairy Queen. And I pair that with the Galenic, like Galen, who was a antique, classical doctor, theorist, a little bit of jack of all trades, but was sort of the foundational way for informing medical theory and practice. And so what that means is that essentially the body and the natural world, everything is made of humors, and the interpenetration of the body and the natural world is really common. And that's part of maintaining your health. So what you eat, what goes out of your body, what you breathe in, all of these things constitute your health or not, or lack of health. So monitoring and controlling that boundary is really important to not only the constitution of the body, quite literally understood through this theory, but also with the implications that that has for one's, you know, masculine performance or feminine performance or whatever. So yeah. The first chapter looks at it from sort of that perspective. The second kind of moves to the next level of the body, which is hair and skin, and looks at practices around hair and skin color in the romances and how that fits in with like these gender performances. So, for example, a really common trope for these lady warriors is they're in their armor, which is indistinguishable from male armor. Everybody thinks they're men. Then they pull off their helmets and their beautiful blonde hair cascades down. So you have this really interesting, you know, moment of revelation, but also the armor is communicating a certain kind of identity that the hair is not at that point. So that sort of sets up the next chapter, which is about armor, really looking at that as a textured surface. And armor is a prosthesis, particularly for, you know, these women and lower class men who are using this high class figure to sort of authorize particular kinds of behaviors or certain kinds of speech. What do you do in armor? You fight. So the next chapter is looks into rhetorical treatises, which usually pair, here's how you become really good at fighting with also here's how you become a good man. And here's why these Italians are terrible. And here's how come English are better. And so there's all kinds of things wrapped up between gender and you know, national identities that I dig into a little bit. And the chapter that will be added now says, you know, okay, what happens when you fight? People get hurt. So it kind of like rips that body back open to understand surgical practices and like the impacts that that has on these performances. And in the romances, we've got, you know, plenty of scenes, of course, of people being hurt and what happens and situations where both it's like the women warriors who are wounded and, the more typical male warriors. So that in a nutshell is the dissertation.
I love it. I think it sounds really great. And I appreciate needing a more like, quote, popular or title for a book. But what I love about academic titles is while they are long and cumbersome, they tell you a lot. And in your title, you have, you know, that we are going to fabricate a martial body. This is not something the universe cares about, but people do. Like, what is a martial body? We invest a lot into that and the cosmos just does not care. So it's like, here's something that must be fabricated. And you have affect positioned between anatomy and armor. And I just really appreciate how you position, you know, this kind of cultural notion of affect in between the body itself and, as you note, the prosthesis that we put on to communicate certain kinds of identity. We touched on this briefly last time. Could you just describe what affect is in your research? You use Ahmed primarily, right?
Yeah, I use Ahmed a lot. I think we had a moment where I was like, well, I could pull the affect theory reader off my shelf and you had it on yours and read you the more tactical definition.
Right.
But because of the background and, you know, that fabricating the martial body, you know, I picked that title, obviously, like you said, because it shows this construction. It's also sort of a pun on Andreas Vesalius's De Humani Corporis Fabrica, the construction or the building of the human body,
neat,
which is the 1543 anatomical text that I work with in detail in the first chapter and is sort of, he's considered the father of modern anatomy. And there's a ton about how anatomy and the body is made. But this informs also my understanding of affect because the passions are not only one of the naturals, but they're also, key to rhetorical performance and persuasion or your failure to persuade. And so the relationship between the body and the coverings on the body, whether that be armor or clothing or hair.
Cascading yellow hair, right? Yeah.
Exactly. That is a very sensitive site for the production of not only identity, but also of confusion, right? And so for me, affect, not only in the sense of, emotions or whatever, but primarily around the ways that rhetorical constructions And also, you know, bodily invested, not only expressions of those passions, but also experiencing of those passions, either as transactional sites, you know, between the body and the external world, or two bodies, or whatever it is. But that for me is really key to not only the way that this martial body is made, but the way that it is deployed and used and sort of reckoned with in not only these romances, but I argue the larger sociocultural context of what is now England and Italy in the 16th century.
It's really fascinating. We're definitely going to get to Star Trek, I promise. But I also want to ask about this other project because it sounds so cool. You sent me a brief synopsis. It says, "Domesticating war is as much an excavation as it is an argument that women and war were inextricably bound in pre-modern Europe." You argue that you demonstrate the benefits of combining diverse methodologies. You say that military activity has long been considered as strictly masculine and certainly not something of the household. Aside from periodic heroines such as Joan of Arc and Queen Elizabeth I, women are largely absent as actors in historiography of war. Although some military historians have explored the presence of women in war, most either do not give any space to women or they dismiss them as merely sex workers. Despite decades of scholars calling for increased interdisciplinary research, military history has largely remained untouched by scholarship about the household and much more invested in masculinity in terms of gender. We have noticed this on the Real War Project. We are seeing lots of men doing a great deal of important things and women bringing drinks. And it's like, there has to be more complexity here. There seems to be so much missing. I was wondering if you could just briefly talk to our audience about this project and where it is and where it's going.
Sure. Dr. Beck, she also did her PhD at University of Minnesota. She's a historian of medicine, and she's now curator at the Wangenstein Biomedical Library, which is our special collections at the University of Minnesota, where we have a really rich collection. We have a 1543 Andreas Vesalius. That's the text I worked with.
Wow.
As well as a ton of these recipe books. And these would often be texts that would be added to over time by many people, could be, you know, handed from one person to another. Sometimes we know who the authors are, sometimes we don't. And her area of specialization is around the medical parts, the medical recipes that are in these texts, but there would be all kinds of things. Things from like how to dye your horse green, to how to make your hair more blonde, to how to like cure yourself of rabies, to like how to make your armor really shiny. And here's how you can make yourself impervious to gunshots. So, you know, there's whole range. Oh, and food recipes, of course, too.
What else do you need? That's everything. Green horse, blonde hair, shiny armor, gunshots can't kill me. Like, I'm ready for war. Let's go.
Ready for war. Yeah. And you have these right in the midst of, you know, much more typical, like, here's what you do when your cow is having her udders like block up, and here's how you treat it. And it's a whole mix of, you know, human animal medicine all over the place. Mm-hmm. So she brings an expertise in these material objects and the use of these different ingredients that are very much materially present in the time period that we both are invested in. And so oftentimes, you know, still people think like recipe books, oh, women, household, etc. And Emily's research has really helped uncover that oftentimes some of the collections were written in monasteries, and there's all kinds of medicine and treatments in there that are directed for women, even though the assumption is that these monks would have like no contact with women or very little. So that's just, you know, kind of one area. So we've paired up together, and she sort of brings her area of expertise around these recipe collections and these, you know, material ingredients and what they were used for, and my more cultural studies background. And that kind of naturally brought us to, okay, well, war, which is my area, and kind of like the home, which is more hers. And we've had so many conversations where we're like, we're really talking about much the same thing, just from different directions. And so that's where this book came from. And one, we're trying to structure it so that we've got a trajectory essentially from what, you know, when you're preparing for war, when you like are at war, what happens, how are you treated? And then the last chapter is sort of on veterans and like returning home or making new homes, and how that disrupts the communities and or can be disruptive to the communities. And in all of these, in each of the chapters and all of the places we're looking into, women are an integral part, not only, you know, in these huge camps, and especially the 30 years where you'd have camps that are 60, 70,000 people on each side. Long, long sieges. So you have some of the biggest cities in Europe at the time are siege sites. You don't have functional cities without a lot of women. And if you look at the actual records, there's women dotted all over the place. You just don't know, like, there'll be ones like, oh, well, you know, she helped cure me because I got hurt in this battle. And so this woman who was my wife came for, you know, this time and took care of me. And then I got better. And then I had another wife. But there's a whole, you know, narrative that's there and has always been there, but not something that really we've paid attention to. Barton Hacker is one historian who's really been key at pointing out, like, there were tons of women all around involved in military activities and the success of or failure of military activities through the time. So we're really trying to look into, especially, you know, using medicine and treatment, which is a common thing that in both the household, stereotypically understood, and the military setting, stereotypically understood, as a way for seeing how women participated in what are very much like the colonial, pre-colonial and nation state building activities that are coming out of, especially the 17th century, and how that really was foundational to the imbrication of women and the household in notions of like what the state should be or can be. And, you know, that sets up very much, I think, the Victorian period, but we're not going there. But that's where the project came from. I'll stop there.
We're boldly going much, much further. But this is such a refreshing take on war culture. It's like, I think it's really interesting to see the linkage, not just of like gender and nation building, but seeing it as the offset to what we typically see with regard to these concepts being exclusively about like notions of patriotism and masculinity and things like that. These are two really important concepts in this idea of war culture, which is something we talk about. I'm curious if you have any thoughts about this term. You know, it's like we're not so interested in the genre of wars and war movies at the Real War Project, but I personally am very interested in how we create our understanding of war, which is kind of what I refer to as like broader war culture. Other people are going to have different ideas of, you know, what culture even is and how it works. How do you frame war culture in terms of like just like the big picture of it? And how do you see any other ways that our understanding of war culture potentially limits our ability to analyze it?
Yeah, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is women's armor. Depictions of women in armor, any video game you've ever played, not only are women, the female characters, skimpily armored, but they have very prominent boob cups. This is a terrible design. Like, just logistically, a blade would be directed or a any kind of an edged weapon right to the sternum, and that's not where you want it. The point of armor is to distribute the force of the blow so that you can you don't have it going in one particular point. So the assumption would be, and always is, and in the modern HEMA, historical European martial arts community, you know, there are times if you're, depending on how tightly you're wearing armor, what the purpose is, if you're doing like reconstruction-y type stuff, maybe you are going to have visible differences, especially if you have a really large-breasted person, between stereotypical male and female armor. But in general, there would be no need for any difference. You would not be able to tell what made an armor, man's or woman armor, who wearing it. And how they identify. But and to combine with that fact, like whenever you go to museums and you see displays of like knights and armor and everything, it's only men. Was armor predominantly owned by men? Sure. But the provenance, like who wore this armor? Who was it made for? Who made it? We know that for like less than 10%, and that's a generous estimation of the pieces of armor that exist. It's a pretty bold claim to project from that provenance to say, you know, women didn't wear armor, especially when we have records from the late medieval and early modern period, you know, other than Joan of Arc, who say, oh, yeah, this like weird Italian lady, she was always in the military camp and she slept in her armor because people wouldn't leave her alone. You have plenty of like instances of this. Are they rare? Certainly. But they're not non-existent. And the assumption that they are that way is partly constructed, not just from the time period, because obviously in the time period, people were recording this happen, although certainly the assumption that war is more of a masculine activity existed, but the reinforcement of it is a construction of the culture that has been built largely because of the ways that we have interacted with the artifacts of history through museums and how those have been, you know, turned into narratives in, you know, our media, movies, and our textbooks. So, you know, I think that the phrase war culture is a really good way of trying to situate the simultaneous sort of grappling with a thing that is war, and then an interpretation of all of the things that like feed into it and what comes from it. And, you know, it's this behemoth that, depending on how you approach it, you can either, you know, valorize it or completely castigate it. But in reality, it's like all those things at the same time, in my estimation.
It's such a great example. Armor says so much. It's not strictly the utility of protecting the body, as everybody knows. It's going to communicate a lot about class, about strength and power. And we don't have the time on this show to detail all of the ways that patriarchy comes coupled with disposability and also just the violence, misogyny against women. Mm-hmm. And we see such a great example here where the whole purpose of armor in theory is to protect the body. But in cultural, like as you say, fictional understandings, we see armor that is very revealing, which is the opposite of the point, and armor that accentuates the body in ways that cause more damage, which is the opposite of what it is for. And that doesn't come without consequence. It's a fascinating wrinkle here. Let's turn to Star Trek. You and I did talk about the politics of Star Trek in episode 8 of That's Debatable. Could you just reiterate for this audience here a little bit about the role that Star Trek has played in your life as a source of what I call ritual and or pedagogy, like watching it as a fan, but also potentially informing some of your understanding of war and war culture and all the stuff that you're interested in now?
Yeah, I mean, I think much like Tim Rapierce informed my research, Star Trek and my love of it, and I watched the original series as like a 4-year-old with my parents, and, you know, watched Next Generation when it was on, and Deep Space Nine and Voyager, and, you know, Star Trek very much, I have a ritualistic experience with it, I think, because it resonated with me in so many ways, and I wanted to live in this world, in this future where, you know, they still have problems, but you can overcome them. And like, you don't pretend that the bad things don't exist, but you sort of face them head on. And so as I would say in especially the formative, like parts of my, you know, young adulthood, like in college, I went to Star Trek for, you know, impromptu speeches, which, you know, you and I did together. And I think almost every impromptu speech I gave probably had some kind of a Star Trek example, because there's so many, there are hundreds and hundreds of episodes,
including in a national final, right?
Indeed, the very last speech I gave, you know, I started it with everything, you know, I needed to learn in life I got from Star Trek or something like that, and I used the episode Plato's Stepchildren, which has the first interracial kiss, and between Kirk and Uhura, which is forced, so there's a whole other thing to talk about there, but it was a huge moment that happened. On TV, there was lots of backlash, and, you know, Star Trek from its beginning has always been, you know, Roddenberry was always pushing notions of what is bad or what is problematic about the world that it is now, and how could it be different? You know, certainly in imperfect ways, but that's always been at the core, at least that what resonated with me, and still continues to resonate with me with Star Trek. And so I would say, I just really loved seeing how the universe is expanding. It's responding very much to current times. I mean, I think Discovery is really a great example of that. I think that Roddenberry would be really proud to see what has been created since he passed.
It's definitely expanded into new and interesting ways. That the newest stuff we've talked a lot about, Discovery, Lower Decks, some of the stuff. I know you said you hadn't seen Discovery yet last time we talked, but just in terms of...
I'm not caught up in this season, this last season.
Okay, okay, cool, cool. So just you've seen it, but not the most recent. Great. Well, this might make more sense then. So yeah, we talk on Real War about what we call the kind of narrative, affective, and production politics of war in cinema. So everything from the design of the Enterprise in Star Trek to the sound politics on board. We talk about the little whistle sound that you hear when the captain mm-hmm. comes on deck. In Star Trek, apparently, there was a real awareness here that wanted to resist war culture. We wanted to design the Enterprise to not look like a warship. And when you look at a Star Wars ship next to the Enterprise or a Battlestar Galactica ship next to the Enterprise, like the differences could not be more plain. Even their shuttlecraft looked like a shoebox compared to what you've got, you know, rocking in those other universes. I'm curious about your thoughts on just this process as a whole. We'll get more specific in a minute. But you see this same kind of resistance, right, to this kind of war imaginary? Did you think of Star Trek as like a war imaginary as a kid? They have uniforms and ranks and things, right? Like, it's a mm-hmm. give and take a little bit, I think.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's the – and probably, I mean, Roddenberry was from the, great generation or whatever, like the last good war, World War II, and we fought the Nazis.
The so-called greatest generation, yeah.
Yeah. We came together and, like, we made things better for everyone, like this fiction that was very pervasive. And you see that in Star Trek, like this is the good military and they're still a military, you know, but it's a federation. So we get lots of people cooperating. And, you know, really what we want to do is protect the weak and we want to make sure people have their voices heard. But it is absolutely a military. And, you know, as a kid, that resonated with me. Was like, well, if I could join that kind of, you know, military and serve on that kind of starship, I would. So, you know, it's like one of those things that is simultaneously, it's like, yeah, we're resisting war culture and being really intentional about trying to focus on peace and, you know, this whole prime directive and letting people like evolve their own ways. But at the same time, there's always the power of the guns behind it. You still have phasers. There are very few ships, and it's a discovery, there are very few ships that don't come with weapons. And you still carry around phasers and you still, you know, get in trouble for breaking rank and doing things that like are very much based on current military codes. I mean, the ranks are like, it's still preparing for war. And, you know, so many of the narratives and like the movies and everything are driven by conflict with like the Borg or, you know, some species. So it's still very much it's about war. It's just a yeah, fuzzier
version. Discovery in the recent season, especially, but definitely throughout, you see the narratives turning to questions that have less to do with war and more to do with like personal or crew development. Mm-hmm. Lower Decks to me is an exceptional example of where we have something that appears to be very kind of socialist in the way that everyone likes each other and hangs out with each other, but the rank hierarchy is literally written into the title. Like, they're lower decks, you know? And you see that distinction between the officer class and the non-officer class. You see the nepotism. We see, like, all of the stuff we see in very conventional war movies just in a very kind of – I've always said that Star Trek uniforms look a little bit like pajamas, and so you call it a fuzzy version. It's like everyone's just wearing pajamas at base camp, you know? It's like – I don't know. It's so interesting. The way that we go in the Real War Project is we watch what we call batches of movies so that we can create intertextual comparisons. So three movies within a batch. And the way Star Trek came up was in batch 10, the batch ultimately was about what we called crews of specialists. So we watched 1961's The Guns of Navarone, which is about a squad of soldiers led by a rock climber who takes out shore guns during World War II. We watched Tears of the Sun from 2003, which stars Bruce Willis as a special operations officer leading his men into Nigeria to rescue aid workers. And then we watch Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, about a starship crew saving whales. And like right away, the narratives here are so different. Like the narrative, just we got rock climbers taking out shore guns. We've got special ops going into Africa. And then we've got, you know, the Star Trek crew that are going to be saving whales. Trek stands out in so many ways. In particular, we talk about gun politics, the politics of masculinity and femininity, the role of the crew within Star Trek. You don't have to be familiar with any of those other movies. Apologies if you're not. But do you have any thoughts on like the kind of crew of specialist trope or just like the crew trope that we see in Star Trek?
Yeah, I love that those are grouped together.
It's so weird.
Because you're right, I certainly would not have thought that they would go together. But
they speak together so much. It's bonkers.
it's so funny. Yeah, I haven't seen those other two movies, but I'm gonna have to.
That's bizarre.
But that crew of specialists is critically important to both Star Trek IV. You need every piece of that crew to be able to get those whales back to the future.
So wild. Whales. I just don't. Sorry. Go ahead.
And I think it really matters that this one was directed by Leonard Nimoy, and he and the story was by him and by Harb Bennett, and that they really wanted an environmental message. They did not want a clear-cut villain. You know, they were really actively trying to, you know, resist the war narrative and try and like focus on environmentalism and how the consequences of our actions now could condemn our entire species in the future. And so, you know, you get this kind of really ridiculous story, but that it's my favorite of the Trek movies. And you have your crew of specialists, and all of them are important. Some of them in ways that are like not completely clear. We need Chekhov to fall down and have his like head hurt on the very militaristic Enterprise that contrasts pretty clearly with the fact that the Enterprise crew is not about the ship. It's just the people, because they're on a Klingon bird of prey. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it really is that crew of specialists that makes the Enterprise. And, you know, we get the medicine scene. We have the doctor so he can cure somebody's like diabetes.
Yeah.
And there are so many of these moments that are just like, what is happening? But all of them go together and I think are, you know, really resisting the kinds of war tropes that you're calling out here. And I think it's really interesting the way the women in Star Trek IV interact. So you have Dr. Gillian Taylor, who basically tells Kirk at the end, like, yeah, buddy, I'm not interested. I just wanted to get to the future. That's all. I'm going to go learn science now.
Wait a minute. Where are you going?
You're going to your ship. I'm going to mine. Science vessel. I got 300 years of catch-up learning to do.
You mean this is goodbye?
Why does it have to be goodbye?
Well, like they say in your century, I don't even have your telephone number. How will I find you?
Don't worry. I'll find you. See you around the galaxy.
She literally meets this dude who says he's a spaceship captain. Turns out he is a spaceship captain. He takes her to this different future, and like every other movie in the world is like, they're going to fall in love and she's gooey about this guy. But when he asks her like out at the end, she's like, I got to go research whales because I'm like a real world renowned expert now. And it's like, what? And the look on Kirk's face when she walks away, I'm just going to carry it with me forever because it's so
I love it.
Perfect.
I love it.
See you around the galaxy.
It's so good. So you have that crew specialist. That's very much true. But I think that what Nimoy and Bennett are trying to do with them, you know, in some eyes of critics and fans fails because it is pretty, you know, there's some plot holes.
Campy.
But yeah, there's that. But, you know, the things that like I really like are, well, I mean, whales, of course, but the contrast between 4 and 5, which, you know, Shatner directed, and they literally go find angry white god dude who's like, really angry and everyone's terrible.
Now, give me what I want.
Cyborg!
And then Kirk's like, yep, well, God lives in the human heart. And Spock's like, excuse me. And there is nothing that I think encapsulates more the conflict that is inherent in the Star Trek universe more than the contrast between those two movies. Like right there, you get very different views of militarism.
Yep.
You know, because I feel like Kirk would, he wanted to kill the aliens right away. He's like, oh, well, I guess we'll just have to blow that probe up. And everyone else is like, whoa, whoa, whoa. That's not the right choice. We're going to go back in time by slingshotting around the sun and get some whales. That's clearly the better option.
Well, the article we talked about was by David Borsima, and it says, "We're not going to kill today, Star Trek and the philosophy of peace." And it touches on that too, and I pointed out in the episode, it's like, it's only pacifist because they cannot blow up the probe. Like, that is definitely their first option. And then it's like, right. No, we'll lose. Okay, so we won't do that. So now what do we do? And it just boggles my mind, I said on the episode, that someone in a writing room said, "We're going to go save whales and bring them to the future." And that cleared the writing room. Like, that made it.
Yep.
And it would have to be someone like Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah. He's like, "No, guys, seriously, we're going to do this. It's going to be great. Everyone will love it."
Yeah, everyone did. That's what I insist. We talked on that That's Debatable episode about how Star Trek was like a TV franchise first. And that really hurts it when it comes to sound politics. Star Wars comes out in the 70s. Sounds exquisite. Mm-hmm. Star Trek rocking at the same time sounds like a TV show. But in this case, it really helps it, we said on the show, because the legacy of this crew, you know, Uhura is famous. Shatner's character, obviously famous. His relationship with Nimoy, very famous. There's just a lot of baggage here. And that transposes in a way that the other movies just cannot capture. You get it? All of the other movies have to spend so much time backing us up on who every character is, whereas with this one, pretty much everyone knows at least enough to drop in on the crew. And that's the production legacy of being a TV show first, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting.
Yeah. I like to, I mean, that's kind of when you see as Star Wars, and I am a fan of both Star Wars and Star Trek, even if I prefer, you know, if I had to pick and, you know, one would go away from my life forever, I would pick Star Trek to stay. But I still really love Star Wars too, is that you, because it started as this like space opera, you get this hyper fixation on, you know, the Skywalker family. Like, it's as if we're watching, you know, like, what is Henry VIII going to do now? You get the same sort of fixation on these very, very powerful people. Whereas because I think Star Trek started as a series, it's about a crew. Granted, it's the top part of the crew. You don't see
the upper deck.
Those in the lower decks, unless they're wearing red and they get sent on an away mission, and then you just know they're going to die.
We all know how that ends up, yeah.
All that good to be red shirt. But it's about that crew and like the relationships between them. And I think that that lets some pretty rich character development happen that is more interesting than, I think, just focusing on like a family.
We've read several different papers talking about how war movie rhetoric has shifted around the 80s and the 90s away from being about the squad and being more about the individual. So I think this legacy is really important just in a lot of ways. I want to touch briefly on this idea that while Star Trek is definitely trying to resist war culture and things, we touched on this at the top. Oftentimes when we try to find like a smart lesson or a critique of warfare, we're just kind of reinscribing all of the same notions of what we talked about in terms of patriarchy, cis heteronormativity, and all of that. We did a great series at Humboldt State before it was called Cal Poly Humboldt that was called Whose Futurities? And we interviewed Dr. Calafell, Dr. Rislingbaldi, and Dr. Lechuga about the future and possibilities of like science fiction and horror. And Dr. Rislingbaldi talks about grown up young indigenous woman watching Star Trek, loving Star Trek, just, you know, defining her relationship with the universe and all this. But the episode that she remembers the most is about Kirk building a dam. And here on Wyatt Land in Humboldt County, they're trying to remove all these dams. And a dam is not an icon of warfare, but it is definitely a weapon of settler colonial warfare. And if we're going to imbricate the home and the culture of war, then settler colonialism is nodding enthusiastically and waving its hand in the corner. Star Trek feels very settler colonial in a whole lot of ways. What other kind of like warfare lessons do you see being just really strongly reinscribed in Trek?
I mean, ultimately that violence is a justified solution. It's very like there is a just war theory operating here. I mean, Aquinas would probably also be a fan because there's a careful analysis that's done and it's oftentimes like played out as part of like the action to determine when is it just to intervene or if an intervention happened and was not just, why not? So there is very much the position that violence is an acceptable solution, particularly when it's used by the quote unquote right people, which obviously plays really right into the, you know, settler colonialism in particular. And that is especially clear when you get, well, there are so many that are invested in that. oh gosh, I'm not gonna, I'm not, they're from the original series on and on, you know, movies about it, but the episode where there's like the Klingons before they had their face change, and the Federation are at a planet and it's like populated by people that seem medieval, and the Klingons want to take the planet over, and it turns out these people are actually super sophisticated, and the Federation is like, no, you can't, and then they're gonna have a war, and then the Omicrons, no, that's the current variant of COVID. I think it starts with an O though. who basically stop, and they're like, they stop the war, put them back on their own ships and say, go away, come back when you both have matured. But they seem to be this simple people that, you know, there's this war that is focused on them. And I think that episode, even though I can't remember the name of it right now, is one that always stuck with me, because it's like, well, what happens if there's no greater power to stop the war? And that's the world we live in, it feels like.
It really does sometimes, yeah. Yeah, and just the whole premise really of boldly going where no one has gone before seems very exciting and discovery oriented, but it's like you weren't invited and yep. Like you yeah. cannot go there without having a consequence. We had great conversations in my debate class about the Prime Directive and how the Prime Directive is itself kind of inherently patriarchal because it assumes separation mm-hmm. in a world that's like cosmologically interconnected. There's no such thing as a Prime Directive. You are automatically invested and accountable the minute you show up in orbit. You get it? Like,
yep.
Interesting stuff there. I don't know. I dig it. Do you think it's possible to make an anti-war movie? So quick little power politics lesson. Foucault says we can't control Z war away. We have to make anti-power that disrupts and delegitimizes mm-hmm. war culture if we want to create a world without war. But every time we try this, kind of like with Star Trek, we end up reinscribing a lot of these lessons that we're trying to defeat. Star Trek enlists people. It enlists people. Yep. Maybe not to be like the worst soldiers in the universe, but it makes a lot of people want a uniform and want a rank and want to be part of that crew. Do you think it's even possible to make an anti-war movie in these contexts?
I guess I would say, as a war historian and a cultural studies scholar, that I can't imagine how. Because I'm not convinced by that Foucauldian reading of power, in particular, because I don't think that you can critique without reifying at some point. And so knowing that is always going to be the case, okay, what's next then? I've always been a little bit more focused on praxis than theory. And so given that we can't, you know, or I think, you can't have this perfect state in which you would have the complete opposite. You know, what kinds of things can be done to sort of help incrementally make things better? And I think that's part of the reason why I love Star Trek so much and why it continues to resonate with me, is because, yep, you're still, and it will have those self-conscious moments where it will say, yes, we're still participating in building this kind of culture, and is this the best thing? Probably not. We don't know, but that's what we're doing. We're just trying to make things a little bit better. And I mean, maybe that makes it a sellout, or me a sellout for agreeing with the position. But I think that particularly when it comes to war, and particularly given the very, very real consequences of violence that we are facing in our world right now, and that we have in our history, anything that can help to reduce that is a positive, even if it is not this hugely transformative, like anti-resistance type thing. So I've always had trouble buying that argument from Foucault.
I appreciate the answer, because I'm deeply skeptical that an anti-war movie is possible, because the only way I say that we know how to tell it is with its own language, and that just replicating the language is all, you know, war
yeah,
spectacle.
And if reality is linguistic
right.
construction, and we're just telling the story with the language itself, then yeah. it's replicated.
And we've talked about how parody can destabilize it, but a lot of people will embrace parodic caricature as a form of like inflating their ego. There's just so many different angles. One of the ways that we have looked at it, films like Jarhead and I'm thinking of the Before the Rain, which a lot of people haven't seen. These movies really get us expecting certain things, and then it just never pans through. It just never gives us what we want. Jarhead comes off like a war movie, but it is a very, very like unsatisfying war movie. So It's like, okay, we've destabilized war rhetoric. Nobody has seen these movies. Nobody likes these movies. Whoever decides to make the movie is just wasting their money, because it's not going to get nearly the coverage that like Behind Enemy Lines got. We said Behind Enemy Lines was like $40 million to make. They had two U.S. aircraft carriers working with them. They made $20 million in their opening weekend, which is twice what Welcome to Sarajevo cost to make. And it's just like, the war rhetoric is so powerful that I'm not convinced that we can replicate it in any way that doesn't feed that machine. But I do. I appreciate, too, that Star Trek can reframe it. We can kind of retranslate what our purpose is here and what the consequences are. And it's clumsy. But that's better than nothing, right? Like,
yeah. I think so too.
I compare Star Trek a lot to Bernie Sanders. Like, Bernie Sanders is like a very clumsy American style progressive. He's definitely not a radical leftist by any global standard.
No.
But he tries so hard, and that's what
he does.
We want.
He tries real hard.
Yeah. And I feel like
it's people who try real hard.
Yeah, it's from a generation. So, okay, we're running out of time here. I'd love to ask you, what are you reading or watching right now that makes you think? Is there anything that's really propelling your learning that you'd like to share?
I am reading Tristram Shandy by Lauren Stern as part of the book project. This is it was published serially. It was completed in 1768, and there is a character called Uncle Toby. He's a veteran, and he is obsessed with like literally recreating the siege where he was injured in the groin. There are plenty of puns about this emasculation and what that means, lots of sex jokes. But he rebuilds the where the siege was out of different components at his house in the backyard. And he takes like different pieces from the house. And there's an incident where his like nephew, like the window falls on him because they took part of the window out to put into the siege. And he's the nephew is fine, who's like the character who's writing the novel, but like that there's literal trauma in the home that is enacted from this sort of reimagination of the war over and over and over again from Uncle Toby. So that's one of the things that I'm thinking about right now, and how that's brought into the home, and you know, certainly our domestic obsession with guns and how that's contributing to tragedy on a mass scale, and like you know, obviously how children are our greatest victims. So that's informing the last chapter I'm working on about, you know, veterans in the home and the disruptive influences from that. Also, next I'm going to read this book called Horrorism that's by an Italian feminist philosopher, Adriana Cavariero. And what the text is, and it's nice and short, which I appreciate, is that words like terrorism. I know. It's like it's great.
I like to read, but it is work.
It is. It's like there's so many words. Yeah. Why are there so many
just
words?
More words on every page? Sorry.
Yeah, it's like under. It's like 120 pages.
Nice.
Yeah. So she, her premise is that words like terrorism and war don't encompass the scope of contemporary violence. And so what she is interested in doing is sort of rendering those terms obsolete. And this word horrorism is what she is sort of explaining and introducing to try to capture that experience of violence. And so I am want to read this as a way of thinking through sort of the more critical framing for the project, which is the next part that I'll be working on. So those are two things I'm reading as part of the project, but that, you know, I think could be really interesting to people for other reasons. Tristram Shandy is a weird piece of 18th century literature.
It's so fun to find old stuff and read it and just get boggled. Like, wow.
It's like, this was so popular. Huh?
Yeah. The Horrorism book sounds fascinating, and it may not be sympathetic, but we've talked on the show a lot about how horror is a much more appropriate genre for war. Charles has said, you know, at the end of, you know, Friday the 13th, you don't want to fight Freddy Krueger or whoever it is. That's not the point.
Yeah.
That's not recruiting you at all. It's like, get away, get away, get away. And when we think about war, we often think about like necessity at the very least, if not heroism and things like that. So that one definitely sounds especially fascinating. I do need to get you to give us the corrections. I've made this joke a few times on the air. I thought it was hilarious that horses might have been especially small in medieval times, and you say I'm mistaken about that. So you want to quickly tell people that I'm wrong about this?
Some horses were very small, but
just not the knights' horses.
The horses that were for knights, I mean, they came from lineages that were bred to be larger.
These are so royal people support. After all, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and they're royal horses. Right. I mean, the Lipizzaner stallions that are at the Vienna Riding School that still perform, like all of those moves came from battle moves. Like those are military horses, and now they're ballet horses, wow. But before that's what they did. Huh. That horse is a particular example of what was bred. So they weren't tiny, but there were plenty of tiny ones, and they didn't get that big until, you know, really the late medieval period. So like if you're looking at the Bayeux tapestry from 1066, well, that's not when it was made, but it's depicting 1066. Those are little horses, and they would have been. So yeah. So you're right.
Good.
Too.
Okay, there's some, I can claim some truth. I just think it's funny because the mythology is that the knight is going to be on this huge stomping horse. And the idea that they're out there riding around on little tiny horses is just not the story that we want. So
yeah. Well, and certainly, I mean, even the, you know, Lipizzaner, like, those are not as big. People imagine that they usually put them on, like, draft horses or something. It's like, that's not what they were riding. They were smaller. That's why they, like, Henry V could jump from the ground into his saddle, like, fully armed. That was partly because he was not jumping onto a draft horse.
There it is. Okay, so we're going to call it 50-50. Aaron's partially right and partially incorrect. And it is good to have a small horse and also adorable and hilarious and not the story of masculinity we want. The Lipizzaner stallions becoming ballet dancers instead of soldiers is fascinating. We've also said we want to take the Navy SEALs and turn them into like a touring, like shoot and road show, like a big muscly men working out, shooting your name in the side of a barn, because we think that's better use than what we see them doing, at least in the news or cinema. But
that'd be great.
Yeah, it's a long way from now. Probably not going to happen. Anyhow, Dr. Taylor did earn her PhD in 2017 from the University of Minnesota. Her research focuses on late medieval and early modern English and Italian epic romances, arms and armor, medical texts focusing on anatomy and treatment of battlefield wounds. Dr. Taylor, thank you so much for taking the time twice to talk to us about this stuff today.
My absolute pleasure. Thanks, Aaron.
This has been Dirt Maps, a tributary to The Real War Project, a podcast about the narrative, affective, and production politics of war cinema. If you enjoyed this episode, you can find more Dirt Maps via The Real War Project. That's R-E-E-L, War Project, wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening.
See you around the galaxy.
Zach and Matt are two veteran horror movie enthusiasts discussing their favorite and not so favorite horror films. Scary movie fans, beware, or listen to Watch No Evil. News, reviews, and deep dives of the television series and film franchises you love. Take a tour of the popular media world with Biggs and Brandon on Not Safe for Network. Charles is a Purple Heart recipient
and cinematographer.
Aaron is a professor and critical cultural scholar. Together, they explore the narrative, affective, and production politics of war cinema on The Real War Project. That's R-E-E-L, War Project. You can find all of these shows wherever you find your podcasts. You can find all of these shows on Redwood Sound Labs.